started. You know, it's hard to know when you're getting close to Pesach, you know, when it's too close and we should stop the shiur. And my instinct is always to try to get in, you know, one more shiur. But I understand that there are a lot of people, especially those who have young kids, who are not in school anymore, because there's this thing in Israel that you don't have to go to school from the beginning of the year. Anyway, all sorts of people who regularly come might be busy either with their kids and or are preparing. So, but nevertheless, I'm glad we tried to get in this third and final shiur before Pesach. This is the last shiur before Pesach. And we've previously discussed broad ideas about Pesach. And then last week we had the shiur, which was very practical, all about the halachos of cleaning the house and preparing your house, and all of those related ideas, which are obviously very, very important. I sent out on the shul list a link to that shiur. I'm not sure if it's on the women's group or not, but it's on the main shul list is a link to that shiur for anyone who still needs it. But for today, our third and final shiur of the series and our last shiur before Pesach, I wanted to do something similar but different than we did last year, and that is to speak about the Haggadah and specifically focus on the Seder. But I want to make two caveats before we begin, and I have a lot to share with you, time permitting. But the two caveats, one is the same as I said last year, and the other is different, because I made a different shiur. The first caveat, which I did mention last year, which is that any Dvar Torah at the Seder that in theory is worthy and worth saying could be said not at the Seder. So don't think that if you don't get it in, and you know, the Seder can be busy and can be hectic. There are a lot of other meals, even if you're lucky enough to be in Israel, so you don't have 2 days of Yontif, but there's, you know, in the beginning and another two at the end. You still have the first day of Pesach, you have the last day of Pesach, there's a Shabbos Chol HaMoed. You're even allowed to say Divrei Torah when you're not sitting down at the dining room table. But even if that's more difficult, but certainly you have three days or six big meals together, so not everything has to be said at the Seder, even though these are going to be specifically Haggadah ideas. But that leads me to my second caveat, which is instead of just giving random Divrei Torah, I hope, which were good, like I did last year, in which you can find online or who knows where, you know, millions of rabbis or speakers give random Divrei Torah shiurim on the Haggadah, I specifically instead today chose to do something a little different, something that I actually never did before, which is I wanted to specifically focus on themes, which I think are absolutely crucial in general in the life of a Jew, but specifically our messages of Pesach are what I believe are the main themes of the Haggadah and of the Seder. And I wanted to illustrate those, of course, those themes with Divrei Torah. And more or less, we'll try to go in order, just because there's no reason to randomly go out of order of the Haggadah. But I don't intend this per se to be, you know, just as we go along, you know, here's a cutesy Divar Torah, and here's a good Gematria, and here's a Rebbe Shemaisa. These things are all nice, and they're fine. I have nothing against them. But I wanted to specifically focus on larger issues and bigger ideas for the simple reason that I realize, you know, we always post these shurim online, and over, you know, you look back 10 years later, and there could be hundreds of people who listened or viewed them. You never know who's listening to them. But the first and primary audience are the people that I'm sitting to talking to live, who are mothers and grandmothers. And I am aware that, you know, mothers and grandmothers aren't always or typically the ones who are giving lots of Divrei Torah at the Seder. Sometimes it has to do with education, but a lot of times, even if women are very educated, they're a little busy that night of the year. And therefore, I'm aware that, you know, little things or there aren't always as many opportunities at the Seder or in general for women to give Divrei Torah. And again, if you're not comfortable doing that for your family, that's fine. But I specifically chose these ideas because these are Divrei Torah, which will lead to things, if you want, which actually could be great discussion topics with your kids, with your grandchildren, with your spouse. And it doesn't have to be just the little, you know, detail of the question and answer or the vort, so to speak, that we're going to discuss. But they really bring up issues which I think are important to us, and the type of issues which you as a mother, as a grandmother, as a leader of your family would want to be conveying to your children and to your grandchildren throughout the year, let alone at the Seder. And it's the kind of things in which I hope, you know, if you so chose, could really spark conversation with your children. So that's why, again, it's not a typical, you know, random miscellaneous Divrei Torah on the Haggadah shiur, even though we will be doing different Divrei Torah, but I really chose them because I'm really choosing not 10 different Divrei Torah. I don't know if we can get to 10, but I did prepare 10. But 10 themes, which I think are important. And I tried to think of a lot of this, especially in light of current events. You may have heard, it's really crazy in the world, and that doesn't compare to how crazy Israel is. So we're living in really, really difficult and unsettling times, and that may very well be on your minds, but I can tell you, if you have children who are certainly adolescent, let alone teenagers or older, they're aware and they're unsettled. This is not a simple time to be going through anything. So with all that in mind, let's actually dig in, and hopefully we can get through as many, if not all, of the different themes that I want to discuss. The first theme I want to mention, very much apropos to what I just discussed, is the fact that I think that many, many people are feeling this year, even more than usual, that the world is chaotic. And things are upside down, and all sorts of things that we used to be able to rely on, and things we used to take for granted, seem to not be there anymore. Instability and chaos is hard for anyone at any age. It is especially, especially difficult for children, for teenagers. Again, this is not a discussion about how you make aliyah and raise your children, but obviously the very act of making aliyah with children is already something that can be unsettling. You turn their life upside down. Again, we do it because we believe it's ultimately going to be good for them in the long run, but we are all aware, even if we've had easy aliyahs, let alone those of us who've had challenges, we're all aware that this is not a simple thing. So children are very, very sensitive to things being chaotic and, you know, the terra firma no longer being so firm underneath their feet. If that's true in general, then the events that are going on, you know, in Israel now are incredibly, incredibly unsettling for people. Just everything that's going on in Western civilization. I mean, you don't know where to turn. You know, you want to look, you know what's going on in France? You know, they're trying to ruin their country. America is certainly trying to self-destruct. Israel, you know, is jealous of America. You know, we can self-destruct first. I mean, it's really, really crazy stuff. So that can be incredibly challenging on a psychological and emotional level. It could also be challenging on an emunah level. And the first point, therefore, I wanted to make is an idea which I think I did quote this last year. It just takes on, I think, heightened importance even this year, is an idea from the Maharal. Where the Maharal points out that it's not a coincidence that the evening, this magical, special evening that we have, is called the Seder. Why is it called the Seder? Seder means the order. Of course there's an order. But in case you haven't noticed, there's an order to everything in Judaism. Right? Why don't we call the blowing of the shofar the Seder of the shofar? Right? There's a certain, we blow this many blasts, and send this many order, tekiah, then shvarim. There's an order. There's an order to everything we do. Friday night dinner, right? Candles, challah, kiddush. There's an order. Why is that the Seder? But somehow dafka here is a Seder. Not only that, in my unofficial poll, every single family I've ever met or asked all start the Seder the exact same way. Kadesh Urchatz, right? We begin, and if you don't have that tune, well, first of all, you should get that tune because that's the tune. But number two is we all start by going over all the different components. Why? We never do that anywhere else. This is a unique thing to Pesach and to the Agada and to Seder. And the Maharal explains that the reason for this is because if you put yourself in the perspective of the Jews at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, everything there looked incredibly chaotic. After hundreds of years of suffering, you know, crying out to God, seemingly not being answered, which obviously created all sorts of questions and challenges for the Jews for those generations, then all of a sudden somebody who you barely know, who had run away first to the palace, so you can imagine the jealousy and resentment they probably had of Moshe when he was in the palace, then he has to run away, they haven't even heard from him, he shows back up, he's 80 years old, and all of a sudden, what, he promises things, it goes from bad to worse. Initially, then all of a sudden you have these crazy, you know, nature, topsy-turvy, you know, plagues, you know, blood. But it still didn't help. And the whole world's turning upside down, and hail and fire and animals. I mean, crazy stuff's going on. And then all of a sudden, after over a year of that, it's, okay, we got to go now. Now. And then all of a sudden they're trapped. I mean, everything is confusing. So says the Maharal. That's why, even though from their perspective at the time, it looked chaotic, but it wasn't. That's from our perspective. But from Hashem, who's looking at it from above, he's like, you know, the puppets are in his hand. You know, there's a choreography. There's a Seder to everything. When you're in the moment, when you're one of the actors, right? If you're in the Truman Show, you don't always see it. You don't always feel it. It can feel chaotic. But first thing which we have to try to believe and emphasize to ourselves and to our children and grandchildren is that it's true, things are difficult, and it's always more difficult when you don't understand. When even something that's difficult or painful, but when you understand it, is easier. When you don't understand something, it's always worse. So the chaos is obvious and potentially unsettling, but I think we have to try very much to emphasize to ourselves. And again, if you don't believe it, then don't say it to your kids, because they could tell that you're faking it. You have to be authentic. But if you can impress upon yourself the fact that, yes, I don't understand what's going on, and like, where is this going to end, and God forbid, could really, you know, who wouldn't give to go back to the good old days of 4 elections, you know, a year? Like, you know, that seems so quaint by comparison to what we have now. If you, you know, you have to work on yourself first before you can project this to your children. But no, I don't understand, and it's even a little scary, and what's going to be, but you know, it's not what we expected. All true. But we believe that there's a Seder. And that's what this night is ultimately all about. So that's, I think, a point which is relevant every year. But it, at least to me, it took on added sharpness when I thought of what's going on this year. Okay, number two. So we start off with Kadesh. And of course, Kadesh is one of the 4 cups of wine that we have throughout the Haggadah. One on Kiddush, one on Magid, one on Benching, and one on Hallel. And this we briefly did mention 2 weeks ago in the Shir, that the source, it's not clear what the source for the 4 cups are. There's different opinions actually in the Gemara. But the most commonly quoted and widely known opinion is one of the opinions which says that the 4 cups are corresponding to the Arba Lashonos of Geula. That's the term that the Gemara uses. The 4 expressions that Hashem gives Moshe to give the Jewish people to tell them about anticipating the future Geula. Right? So we have V'hotzesi, V'yitzalti, V'ga'alti, and then V'lakachti. I'll take you out, I will save you, I'll redeem you, and then I'll take you to be my people. Arba Lashonos of Geula. However, what's interesting and not as well known is that there is a parallel text in the Talmud Yerushalmi that gives the same answer, but has a slightly, slightly different formulation. According to the Yerushalmi, the reason we have the 4 cups is not because there are 4 Lashonos of Geula, the 4 expressions of redemption, but rather corresponding to the Arba Geulos. Not Lashonos Shel Geula, but the 4 redemptions. Now, presumably it means the same thing, but it's a different formulation. And it really begs the question, and this is raised by the author of the commentary on the Chumash known as the Torah Tamima. It says, what is going on here? Right? It's a classic catch-22. Mimon Afshach. If we say the way we usually were raised and taught to think, that there are 4 expressions of Geula, what does that really mean? That there was one Geula, which is described in 4 similar, if not synonymous, terms. Well, if that's the case, then there should only be 1 cup. What's the difference? The fact that someone is verbose, right? Speakers in general have long known, writers and speakers have known, that there's something hardwiring in the human brain that 3s work good, right? Martin Luther King was a master of this in his oratory, and plenty of other writers, and, right? I try when I can, right? So why 4, not 3? Not the point, but the point is, sometimes as a speaker, as a writer, you will convey the same thing over and over again, right? I think it was Winston Churchill who once said, as a speaker, right, the people listening only first start hearing it when you've repeated it enough that you're sick of hearing yourself say it. Right? Just saying something once doesn't work, right? You're married, you know. It doesn't work, right? Husbands aren't even listening the first 2 times. We that's built in. We just assume that we're going to be reminded the 3rd time, so we wait till then. So, but it's only one, but there's still only one Geula. Only one Geula, so why 4 cups? And on the flip side, what does that mean that it's 4 Geulos? It's not 4 Geulos, it's only one at once. So says the Torah to me with something very profound. Yes, in terms of the ultimate goal, if the ultimate goal is leave Egypt, become free, become my chosen people and go to Israel, then there is only one Geula and only one goal. However, he says that, in fact, these weren't 4 synonymous terms, because Hashem broke up the redemption. He broke up the Exodus into 4 different, distinct, and actually tangibly different, concretely different steps. That is to say, the first language, the first term of Ahotsesi, describes the fact that initially they were still slaves, but Hashem lowered the burden. He made sure that the burden was less, the pressure was less. It was not as painful, it wasn't as difficult. But they were still slaves. Then came V'hitzalti, says the Torah Tamima. That means they were actually free and emancipated. But they still lived in Egypt. They were still second-class citizens. They still had a slave mentality. They were still multiple generations of disenfranchisement. They weren't really, really where they would want to be. Then came V'ga'alti, you're actually physically going to be liberated. You're going to leave Egypt and become a truly free people. But a free political people, a politically free, wandering the desert with no guidance, with no mission, with no meaning in life, that's also clearly not what we want. And therefore we have the fourth language of Velakachti. Now it's not only freedom, but purpose. A life of freedom, again, I understand from a political Western perspective, we speak about freedom as the highest good. But it's a mistake. Certainly from a religious or even a psychological perspective. Right? Freedom without meaning is a different form of slavery. Right? A person needs to have meaning in his or her life. Now, obviously, we think that predominantly that meaning comes from religion and spirituality. But even if a person has a secular meaning, still, there needs to be meaning in his or her life. So that only happened in the fourth stage of Ve'lakachti. So therefore, says Atar Tamima, it all depends on your perspective. Yes, if you only think about the finish line and the ultimate goal, there was one Geula. But what the Yerushalmi is telling us by this parallel, less known formulation of Arba Geulos, is that in fact, there can be Geula before there is Geula. Each stage in the process where things got even just a little bit better is a form of redemption. Incomplete. But just because it's not perfect doesn't mean it's not good. And each step along the way, we have to be able to acknowledge the little victories and the marginally better and the partial salvations. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. Again, many of us are wired that way, but it's not healthy. And from a moral perspective, certainly when you view the way other people do things for you, or when we look at Hashem, it's not even right. Not everything has to be perfect, and not everything has to be perfect right now. So yes, we want Mashiach, and we even want Mashiach now. And that was on a bumper sticker, right, for most of my childhood, so, right? But it doesn't have to mean that until we had Mashiach, and if it's not now, we have nothing. There's so many different stages. And says the Torah Tamima, what this is coming to teach us, and this is, I think, our second and profoundly important theme of the Haggadah and the Seder, is that Hakaras HaTov, gratitude, requires people to be able to, whether it's gratitude towards Hashem or gratitude towards our spouses or our children or any other one else who's meaningful in our life, to be able to see all of the little things and not just to, even just looking at our lives, right? If a person just looks at their life and just says, well, these are the ways, it's not perfect, you'll be miserable. And I have bad news for you. You will always be miserable because it's never going to be perfect. So what we're being taught by this, I think, is something so important, which is that we have to be appreciative of all the different ways that we have been blessed, even when things aren't perfect. So we begin already, we raise a glass. Even though at the beginning it was just Vahotsesi. They were still slaves. They were still in Egypt. They just had a little less work. But that was a something. That's a marginal improvement. We'll take it. So you have to look for, I think, the small things. And I think in our own personal lives, we have to be appreciative of what we have and what we've been blessed with. Even when things are not perfect. We all have so much to be thankful for. And we have to look at our own lives and ask, you know, how many cups of blessing? I think if we really did an honest, thoughtful cheshbon, you know, writing it down in a journal or a diary, how many things do I have to be grateful for? There'd be a lot more than four cups. And that's not whitewashing the problems that each of us have in our lives and the challenges and the painful things that we have in our lives. But we also are blessed with so many good things. And if I started off in my first idea, talking about the chaos and the challenges of the time that we're living in, and even specifically in Israel, all true, and yet there's Israel. We're here. This is like unbelievable. Right? Most, you know, what would your grandparents and great-grandparents have given for that? They couldn't even have imagined it. So, yes, it would be nice if the country was a little more functional. It would be nice if I actually got my credit card in the mail. I'm still waiting. They promised me 1 week. It's been 3 weeks. It would be nice if I didn't have to go to the post office ever again. There are a lot of things that could be better. It would be nice if my son didn't have to draft to the army the week after Pesach. There'd be a lot of things that could be better. But it doesn't mean it's not great. It doesn't mean there isn't a lot to be thankful for. Okay, next. Obviously, if you had to pick one thing, which is like the meta theme of the whole Haggadah and the whole Seder, the answer would be, if you had to pick one, it would be chinuch, education, or what we would call parenting. So a few of the different ideas I'd like to mention as we continue are really drop-down menu, you know, subcategories of that meta-theme of chinuch. And the first point I'd like to mention, which I think is a few of the ones that we'll get to, I hope, time permitting, I think are ways that we can look at or relate to our children and our grandchildren. But the first one I want to speak to, not about advice, if you will, or practical ways to be mechanech, to educate or to parent, but rather things that we need to do just looking inside ourselves. And this, I want to share with you an idea. Last year, if I remember correctly, last year they came out in Esh Kodesh in Woodmere with the Rabbi Moshe Weinberger Haggadah. So I was able to get it right before Pesach last year, but I barely opened it. So last night I opened it up more in earnest, and I saw that Rabbi Weinberger asks something, or shares an idea, very, very profound, in the name of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Right, so we have very early on in the Haggadah, we have Yachatz, Karpath, Yachatz, right? What do we do at Yachatz? So the father of the house, or whoever else has a Seder plate in front of them, they break the middle matzah. What do we do with the middle matzah? We break it into two uneven pieces. The bigger piece is hidden somewhere. That's what we say for the Afikomen. And everyone's got their different minhagim. The kids steal it, or the parents hide it. Everyone's got... That's the bigger piece. It's saved for much, much later. Hours later when you're already exhausted and overtired. That's the Afikomen. And then the smaller piece stays in as part of, in between the two other matzahs, for lechem oni. So Rabbi Nachman of Breslov asked, why are we saving dafka, the bigger piece, for the Afikomen? What's the symbolism in that? So he explained, again, I didn't see this inside, but this is the way Rabbi Weinberger summarized it. He says this is actually coming to address one of the most profound challenges of religious life generally, and again, it could apply to many things, but certainly and specifically applies to, I think, parenting. And that is, how do we deal with the frustration of putting in tremendous effort and energy into something, and then we don't necessarily see it bearing fruit? Again, it's hard to have anything difficult or any disappointment in life, but it's al achas kama v'kama, much, much more difficult when we've put in a tremendous amount of effort. I don't know if I ever gave this as a drusha here, so if I ever do, you'll pretend you never heard it before. But once upon a time, I think when I was still in Baltimore, I know I mentioned once on a Kol Nidre drusha, the fact that in the Machzorim, it mentions the tefillah. It's really not really the tefillah at this point. It's a poetic in rendition kind of offered by Chazal. But there's a tefillah that Kohen Gadol would say after he finished all of his avodah on Yom HaKippurim and all the stuff he had to do in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And it's an alphabetical. You'll see this. It's in all the Machzorim. It's alphabetical. And then after you're getting through the Aleph Ad Tav, it adds three more things. So if there are three more things that are so important, they have to be added, even though the alphabet was concluded, they're really, really important. So they once gave a whole drusha about what those three things are. Well, one of them is that the Kohen Gadol prayed to Hashem at that magical moment after leaving the Kodesh HaKadosh on Yom Kippur, that the coming year should be a year in which no woman miscarries. It's there, it's in the Machzor. It's been hiding in plain sight your whole life. Maybe you didn't notice it, it's there. So it's a surprising kind of thing. I'm not, you know, not to minimize what it means to miscarry, but if you imagine all the maladies and the tragedies that someone could suffer, you wouldn't necessarily rank that near the high. Even if you were talking about, God forbid, a mother and children, right? Throughout history, children died in childbirth. Like, they were born and they died. Mothers died, right? I think, you know, as the least qualified person in the room to talk about this, I would assume that those things would be considered much more bigger tragedies than, right? So the answer that we suggested, it wasn't mine, was from a Sefer Shem HaTov, was that of all the maladies, you could say cancer, you could say this disease, there's so many diseases out there, and we pick miscarriage. Because it highlighted this idea of, again, as the least qualified person in the room to describe this, but a mother, and even an expectant mother when she's pregnant, right, there's so much sacrifice, pain, stress, difficulty, and yet why does a mother go through this? Why does a woman go through all this? Let alone the actual pain of labor and delivery. Because of the promise of the thing that's going to come at the other end of that. A child. To go through all of that pain and then not have a child. Have a miscarriage. That it wasn't just the pain of miscarriage. It's that the pain of miscarriage has to be understood. It's much deeper than that. It's the pain of unfulfilled sacrifice. It's the pain of giving and sacrificing and dreaming and investing and suffering for some goal which then is not realized. That is deeply scarring in a way that just, God forbid, a random bad diagnosis, as bad as that is, but it's a completely different type of problem. So in a similar vein, says Rabbi Nachman, in life, again, that was just an example, a digression, but it's the same idea. Says Rabbi Nachman, one of the challenges in life, it could be you spend years building a business, then it falls apart. Years working on a marriage, then it falls apart. Years investing in a child, it doesn't turn out the way you want, or God forbid worse. There's so many examples in life, in every area, where, again, it's one thing when bad things happen or disappointments happen, but it's much more difficult to deal with when we've really invested and tried hard. And it's also true, says Rabbi Nachman, or Rabbi Weinberger, or some combination thereof, in our own relationship with Hashem. In other words, most of us, I wouldn't say most, all of us, not only do we do the mitzvos, we want to have a relationship with Hashem, we want to be inspired, when we show up to shul, we don't want it to just be boring, and we want to, if I had a choice, I'm coming anyway. I want to be able to really feel on a high. Or even if I don't go to shul, I'm davening at home, but I'd like it to feel like I'm really talking to Hashem. And I want to have an incredible Pesach, and I don't just want it to be, oh my God, more work, and it's so hard to be a woman, and I want it to be meaningful. We all want, and yet so often, we do the mitzvot, so we don't feel the payoff. We don't feel like we're getting, you know, the payoff and the reward, the spiritual one, the emotional one. Right? This is, again, it could be in mitzvah life, professional life, married life, parenting. There's so many areas. And says Rabbi Nachman, this is what Yachatz is coming to teach us. That we have to realize that we can't get disillusioned. People have, it's human nature, we all have expectations of cause and effect, of more immediate and desired results. We want immediate gratification and immediate success. If I did this, I want the expected payoff to come. And Yachatz is teaching us that and this is apparently, again, I'm no expert in Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, but Rabbi Weinberger is. And he says this is something that is rampant and consistent through his writings, and that is that we have to remember that we have, the key to life is doing the things that we believe are right because they're right, not because there's going to be a payoff. Right? Or to paraphrase, this is my addition, but you know, the Rambam and others speak about, you know, doing the MS because it's MS. Not because it'll also, good things also do have benefits, but you can't focus on the benefit, you can't focus on the desired result. We have to focus on doing the things that we think are right, because we think they're right. And we have to believe that eventually there'll be results. It could be many years later, and it may not even be in our lifetime. But yes, there are results, yes, there is a reward, but you can't do it because you're expecting to see it now. Now we do things because, as far as we understand it, this is the right thing to do. And therefore, says Rabbi Nachman, we hide the bigger piece of matzah, and we only reveal that much, much later, to highlight that in life and in religion, most of our efforts are not going to reveal themselves until the very end. It's only yachat, it's only the achvikomen that you get the big payoff. In the short term, it could be a broken, small piece of broken matzah. The big piece, the big payoff, the thing that we really want, sometimes in life we get immediate results. But usually, that's actually not even the best kind, right? You want an interest-bearing, you know, dividend. The long-term compound interest is where the real money is. But that means you have to wait. And it's hard to wait, especially when you don't see things initially. So Yachatz teaches us to have a little faith and patience that the bigger piece, the bigger payoff, sometimes comes later. And I think this is, again, true in so many areas. But I especially think this is true when it comes to parenting, right? It's a cliche, but you know it's a cliche because it's true that there is no manual on parenting, and you know the least qualified people are the people who are the ones entrusted to do it. Right? But somehow we all figure out more or less a way to muddle through. Sometimes we see the immediate payout. Right? Our children are who we envisioned and who we wanted, and we get nachas and all that other good stuff. And sometimes not. Now, it's really, really painful to consider, but if we're being honest, it's certainly possible that sometimes we made mistakes, right? Because we're not perfect and there was no manual, and parents, people do make mistakes. But it's at least as likely, and I think, especially with good people, it's more likely that you didn't make any mistake. Just life is hard. Parenting is complicated. Every child is a world into themselves, who you may know as a parent better than anybody else, but even you don't know. No one really knows what's going on inside another person. And as we all are sensitive to now in our generation, people don't know what's going on in themselves. Right? That's why people need therapy and need psychoanalysis and all sorts of things. So if they don't know what's going on sometimes inside themselves, how's someone else supposed to know? You as a parent are supposed to know what's going on inside of a teenager? That's laughable. They don't know what's going on inside themselves. And the last person in the world they would want to reveal it to are their parents. That's not easy. So it could be that you did make mistakes, and we're not perfect, and that's a hard thing to confront, but I'm not a person who likes to sugarcoat things. But it's at least, if not more likely, that you made no mistakes. And yet it still didn't turn out the way you wanted sometimes. That is very, very hard. Very hard. But we have to believe that the bigger piece of matzah is something. Just because it doesn't turn out the way you want now, doesn't mean that there isn't some long-term goal and benefit that will ultimately be received. And I think it was when it came, I think they say it in the name of the Stipler? I can't remember who said this, but he says, you know, every parent's tears, every parent's tefillah is answered. But not always right away. Sometimes the payoff could be years later, and sometimes the payoff could be generations later. There was a story, I think it's in one of the Praying with Fire books. I think it was from the Stipler, the Chazon Ish. There was a certain, the story, the details are not important. There was one of these cases where someone became a Baal Tshuva in the most random, like unpredictable, shocking kind of way. And it turns out this person was like the grandchild or great-grandchild, I think it was, of somebody who had been a big, big tzaddik, whose son, you know, went completely off the derech. And I think it was the Stipler who said he's convinced that when that child was going off the derech for this big tzaddik, that tzaddik, who knows how many tefillos that father and mother were davening and crying, the child should be the way they wanted. And in their lifetime, they never saw, you know, they might have died thinking their tefillos weren't answered. So their tefillos weren't ignored. Because their great-grandchild, the grandchild of that child, became a Baal Tshuva in the schus of those parents' tefillos. I'm much more recent. So you might say, you know, for those of you who like that story, that's great. For those of you who are like a little very cynical and whatever, come on. Okay, it's fine. But just yesterday, I heard with my own ears from the actual people something that was somewhat similar, and it's remarkable. There is, some of you probably have heard of the 1840 podcast. So I was listening to it yesterday, and had a very, very powerful, really one of the more powerful ones I think I ever heard, presentation of three couples. He touched the third rail of from families whose children intermarried. I thought in one of the two of the cases, people who went to like the most prestigious Beis Yaakovs, and a few years later were marrying non-Jewish men. Like, wild stories. And to his great credit, it's not an Rothschild book. They're not happily ever after all three stories. There's some really painful, difficult stuff. And the people themselves, the parents, and the people themselves were willing to talk about it. It was really gripping. But the third story, that's the happy ending one. He was smart enough to use that as the third one. Incredible story. Of a Beis Yaakov girl. Grew up in Beis Yaakov in Toronto. Got into BJJ. And not that many years later is intermarried. It's a shocking story. But it happened. She talks about it. And the incredible thing is, now, she and her husband, he converted, and they're from. So it's an amazing story. Again, the other two stories don't end that nicely. But that one is an amazing story. But what's one of the keys? Unfortunately, the mother had abandoned this girl, I think, or something. I'm not sure the details, I forget. But the mother was out of the picture. But the father was this from guy who raised his children when his wife left, and his wife had her own demons. That's a quote from the daughter. But whenever the wife basically left the family, the father raised them. And obviously the father was beyond, beyond brokenhearted, of course, that his daughter intermarried. But she says on this podcast, says, all the years I was dating, then engaged, and living with, and married to my non-Jewish husband, every single Friday he called me on the phone, not only to wish me Shabbos, but to bench me like he did when I was a little girl. Every single Friday. And she's absolutely convinced that that was the key to everything. It's an unbelievable story. That's the broken matzah. All those years, could you imagine the pain that father was going through all those years? And he didn't know that this story was going to end up good. That's one of the rare stories where we get to eat the broken piece in our lifetime. We get to have the happy ending. But it doesn't always happen in our... But again, that's not an article book. That you can listen to it. Go online, you can listen to it. It's there. The people are talking. They're not embarrassed. They're vulnerable, they're real, it's an incredible story. So that's, I think, a second and important theme, which is that when it comes to chinuch, there are no guarantees. There are no guarantees. We all in life, you buy a car, you buy a microwave, and when you pop out a kid, we all want the same thing, a guarantee. Right? We all want it, but there are no guarantees. There's faith that in the end Hashem knows what he's doing, and at some point we'll get to taste the broken matzah, the bigger piece. But there are no guarantees, and sometimes in the short term, it's hard. And that's something that we really have to, again, work on, because it's very, very hard. I don't do well. I'm very rigid. Just ask my family. And I have very high expectations for myself and others. I rationalize my high expectations for others, because I'm not a hypocrite. I have high expectations for myself also. But and I think there's a lot of positivity that comes from that, for myself and the people around me. But not always. I'm aware of that. So I'm not saying this is easy. Especially if you are the type of person or parent who has high expectations and pushes you, the people around you to be the best they can be, it doesn't always work. And to deal with that frustration at the same time, again, so sometimes you have to realize that maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should have a different parenting style, or maybe I should work on myself. That you have to be honest and courageous enough to be able to deal with that. But sometimes you're doing everything absolutely right, and it's just out of your hands. And the ability to accept that, and with faith that, you know what, I'm doing what's right because this is what's right, and the best I can, then Hashem will figure out where the big piece of matzah, when we get to eat that, that takes a lot of faith and fortitude. But I think it's one of the lessons that we have to really try to work on. Okay, another idea, which also relates to chinuch, and I think very, very important, for those who were at the 8:15 minyan in shul this past Shabbos, this dovetails with my drasha of this past week, and that is the importance of conveying, this is maybe the single most mahuti thing I'm saying that's really connected to the Seder and the whole Haggadah and Magid, and that is the importance of stories. And you know, maybe the most important, most obvious lesson that could be missed because it's hiding in plain sight of the Haggadah and of Magid particularly is how important it is and the primary, the primacy that Judaism places on conveying to our children, to our grandchildren, that you have to know our story. You cannot be a Jew if you don't know the Jewish story. And I want to just convey this point, aside from the fact that it's just obvious, but beyond that, with a specific idea. I may have mentioned this in a previous year, I don't remember, but it's one of those ideas which I find so important it would be worth repeating anyway. A question that's already asked in some of the Rishonim is, you know, one of the central and most famous pieces of the Haggadah, of course, is the Manash Tana. Right? The four questions, the fear kashas, every family's got a different minug, how you do it, and especially when, like, you know, there are a lot of families where the youngest child is already, like, married. But I know families where they still make that youngest child say it, or by that point, hopefully there's grandchildren, so maybe they do it, but until there's grandchildren, it doesn't matter how, and my family, it doesn't matter how old you are, if the children are saying it until they're married, you know. Marriage was a patur. You know, that was my parents' motivation to get the kids married. You know, once you're married, you don't say Manatana anymore, but until then, you are saying it. Right, and some people go through all the grandchildren, and everyone's got their way. And in some families, like in ours, after all the kids say it, then the whole family, adults, everyone, we all sing it together afterwards. Everyone's got their minhag. Fine, great, you should do your minhag. But we ask four questions, right? Don't I deserve an answer? What's the answer to Manash Tana? What's the next thing that happens in the Haggadah? Avodah Mayinu. Right? We might call that a dodge. We never answer. Tell me where. Show me where. Where do we answer the questions? We have four questions. It's the centerpiece, the most famous part of the whole Haggadah. There's no answer. This is already a question that's asked by the Rishonim. So a lot of different answers over the centuries. But my favorite answer, I think, was offered by a contemporary rabbinic scholar from Israel. Some of you may know the name of Eli Sadan. Eli Sadan is one of the great visionary leaders and, from many people's perspective, heroes of modern-day Israel. Eli Sadan is a Talmid Chacham and a Rav who lives in Eli, the Yishuv Eli in the Shomron, and his most famous, not only, but his most famous accomplishment is that he not only founded the Mechina of Eli, he founded the entire movement of Mechinot, which is one of the popular ways for religious young men to prepare before going to the army. I think there's about 20 Mechinot now, and many, many people, including in Ramat Beit Shemesh. It's not only in Efrat or something, but in Ramat Beit Shemesh too, including in this shul, at least one that I know of that I'm thinking of at the moment, people who've gone to a Mechina before going to the army. The whole movement was founded by Rav Sadan. And he also is the head of the most prestigious of all the Mechinot, the Mechina in Eli. So he's somebody in the Eli, somebody that I've been close with since we lived in Baltimore. And he has a Haggadah, which is a very nice Haggadah. And in there he brings down this question, and he offers the following, I think, very unique, but I find it very powerful answer. And he suggests that, in fact, rather than being a dodge, or not answering the question, in a sense, really, Avodah Hayinu is actually reflecting a sound educational technique. If you think about it, all four of the questions of Manash Tana are harping on or focusing on anomalous details of the Seder, right? Why do we eat what we eat? Why do we lean? Why do we do what we do? Right? They're good questions. They're legitimate questions. But they're all details. Details about things that we're doing different tonight than we do any other night. So says Rav Sadan, when it comes to answering these questions, we deliberately don't answer the question right away. We ignore the details, and we take a step back, and we focus on the larger picture, the more general issues. You have to, before you can get into the details and the nitty-gritty of halacha, you have to understand why we do any of this stuff. We're part of the Jewish people. There's a story. There's a grand, the greatest story in all history ever told is the story of the Jewish people. There's never been a story with the highs and the lows, the various narrative arcs, the shocking, the disappointments, the pain, the redemption, everything you could imagine if you were getting, you know, a master's in literature and fine writing. You can write a better story. It's the story. But people have to know it. You cannot detach, said Rav Sadan, you cannot detach the living daily Jewish life and the nitty-gritty details of halacha from the grand story. Alienation, again, can take many forms, but a very, very common, maybe the deepest form of alienation that can happen with children from Yiddishkeit, it's not because a particular halacha was hard for them. You know, for boys, maybe minyan or learning, and for girls often it could be tznius or other things. Some people embrace them, it's easy, and then they love being religious. And for that X percentage of boys or girls who have this difficulty with that mitzvah or that mitzvah, that can be very, very difficult. So, again, I'm not making one diagnosis for every challenging situation, of course not. But in many of the cases, and I think Sadan is correct, there's a meta issue going on, which is a child becomes alienated from the Jewish story. In other words, they don't see the connection between why I have to do this or not do this. The big story, I'm convinced, would be a winner for most kids and most people, even with the challenges of Jewish history. What a story to be a part of. Who wouldn't want to be, to use, you know, Rabbi Sacks, probably his most famous book, where he talks about, you know, someone asked him, you know, for children, for younger generation, why should we continue Judaism? He talks about how every Jew, you know, is a letter in the Torah scroll. Every Jew is a letter, every family is a word, every community is a sentence. You can't write the story of Jewish history and the Jewish people without every one of us. We're all a player. So who wouldn't want to, you know, even if it's a small part? Right? Some people get the lead. Some people are in chorus. Some people are the backup, but you can't, right? You can't have a great production without if I gave you a chance to be part of the greatest story, the greatest show ever shown in the world, who wouldn't want to be part of that? Okay, now you find out it's a lot of practice and it's hard. Okay, so when you can see why all those details, all those things I have to do, which sometimes are hard and sometimes I don't understand, when you see its connection and the contribution that it plays to the grand Jewish narrative and the big story, then it becomes meaningful. But when you disconnect, when you have some level of disassociation or alienation from the details, the nitty-gritty of Jewish life, that's disconnected from the big story, which is really what provides the meaning, then you are really at risk. So says Rav Sadan, somebody comes to you and says, I don't understand why you have to do this and this and this. It could be that they already really know the big story and they just don't understand that. But in many of the cases, what they're really asking is, not about the detail of, you know, why does my skirt have to be this length and not that length? And they're not asking about, they're asking a much deeper question, which is, what does this have to do with the big picture? What does this have to do with what's really going to provide meaning in my life, where I fit in the world, where I fit in Jewish history? So says Rav Sadan, in order to answer that question, you don't just answer by pulling out the Mishnah Brura and explain, this is why we have to drink this much of the cup, and this is why you have to daven this much or dress this way. That's not going to work, most likely. If the real issue is not the detail, the real issue is the disconnect between all those things and the big picture. So it says Rav Sadan, the real answer is the best educational technique is not to go right into the details. First, we have to take them on a very, hopefully, a powerful journey through the story, the highs and the lows of Jewish history, and understand the arc of Jewish history and the role, hopefully, that everyone, every generation, and every person sees. When the details are separated from the general background, then you can't understand or appreciate any particular detail. And therefore, says Rav Sadan, we dafka begin with that whole big section of Magid, to go through the origin story, right? The OG, the origin story of the Jewish people, to understand where we're coming from and what it's all about. Only then, at the end, towards the end of the Haggadah, Pesach al Shema, Matzah al Shema, we do. Now, he points out that we don't even answer all the questions then. Some of the real details we actually never answer in the Haggadah. And now's not the time to maybe address why that is. But eventually we do get to giving answers. But it's not right away. It's not a dodge. It's actually a much more sophisticated and subtle educational technique. Because we have to realize that the details have to be understood naturally through the experience of Jewish life. Naturally through an experience, hopefully a gratifying one, of being happy and seeing the meaning in one's life as connecting to the grand narrative of Jewish history. When you understand the Avadim Hayinu and everything that happened, and then you can hopefully appreciate, even if you don't understand every detail, and none of us, including me, understand every detail of halacha, but to understand the details and appreciate them without seeing the connection to the grand narrative of Jewish history and Jewish experience, that is, again, if you have somebody who's just naturally spiritual or naturally is a do-gooder and a goody-two-shoes, so they're going to do the right thing anyway. Right, that's the those are the kids who mislead us. Right, we think that they're really tzaddikim, and they're not. They're just rule followers. Now, if they end up being rule followers their whole lives, then the interiority of their life may not be close to Hashem. But that's really between them and Hashem. No one will know, even their parents, maybe not even their spouse. But what often happens is you have people when they were younger who are just rule followers. But since no one ever addressed their neshama, when they get older, then there aren't any rules because they're adults. They're not necessarily going to follow any rules anymore. Or if they never really had a connect. So it's important to really connect people on a deep emotional level. And again, that's something we have to do all year round. But the most intense possibility for that really is the Seder. So I think that's a second chinuch-related idea, which is the importance of connecting our children to the big story, the good and the bad. That's why it's so critical. It's not a coincidence that one of the key points of the Haggadah and Magid is Maschil Bignus U'Masayim B'Shvach. We don't just tell the good stuff. It's a new thing that we put the skeletons in the closet. We put everything under the rug. But the Torah's perspective is you have to be honest about everything. Again, not everyone's has to be age appropriate. And I said in Shul this past Shabbos, I spoke about it as parents. How if all you do is ever tell your children about all your great successes and how perfect you were and how everything was always good for you, it makes you feel good and it may even impress your kids when they're younger, but it's not helping them. Because then the first time they have challenges and they have failures in life, they'll see themselves as totally disconnected who their parents were, and a disappointment to themselves and to their families. If you share the arc of your life, the good times and the bad, the challenges and the good parts, the successes and sometimes the failures, and including mistakes, you are inoculating them years in advance for when they have their own challenges and their own disappointments, their own failures. Again, I added, I'm not saying you have to say everything. There could be certain things that you're embarrassed to tell, you know what I'm saying? But this idea that you're going to pretend that you are perfect, that everything was always good for you, again, I'm not even just talking about religiously. I mean, There are families, you know. Right now, everything looks good. We live in a beautiful house, and we have money. Maybe it wasn't always the case. Maybe you used to be poor. Maybe you used to struggle. So why shouldn't that be part of the story the child grows up with? That it was always this way? And not only was it not always this way, it doesn't always mean it will necessarily be all this way. People go through different cycles in life, and that builds resilience. So I think this is an educational thing for the Jewish people and for each and every family. Next, another chinuch idea, which again I think I may have mentioned in previous years, but I'd like to highlight just because I think it really is important. And that is the importance, again, something that if you ask my own children, they might say I struggle with this. I don't think I do, but you know, I wouldn't be the first parent who doesn't view himself the way his children view him. And that is the need to see the best in our children. You know, it's only legitimate, even theoretically, to have expectations of our kids if we truly believe and convey to them that we think they're capable of it. If you actually don't think that they're capable of it, or they don't think that you think that they're capable of it, and yet at the same time you also have high standards, so all you've done is set them up for failure. Right? So you have to really, really believe that they're capable of it if you're going to have high standards. And this is an idea that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to emphasize very regularly. You know, we say there are four children, four sons, four children. Chacham, Rasha, Tam, Sheinodei, Lishol, right? So he asked, it sounds like almost like a silly question, but you know, I think he's trying to raise a deeper point, which is, Echad Chacham, this is the wise son. How do you know? How do you know which one is which? They're wearing a sign? Every kid comes with a label, they pop, you know, you give birth to them and it says, this will be the child who gets into Harvard, this will be the child who gives you trouble throughout high school, this will be the trouble that only gives you nachas, how do you know? You don't know. So said Rav Kamenetsky, Ein Echanami, you're right. And therefore he says, the lesson really is, when the children are younger especially, you have to start off by assuming that every child is the Chacham. You assume the best in the child. Now, obviously, as children develop, you will see milos and you'll see challenges. things that they need. And you can't treat every child the same, and you can't treat every child unrealistically. But it has to come from a place. The default is, my child is amazing. Now, this is something that's much easier for grandparents. Just ask the grandparents, they'll tell you, my grandchildren are amazing. My kids were, but my grandchildren are perfect. This is something that every grandparent knows. But it's important that the default for parents also be, my children, you start off with that. And he pointed out something amazing, halacha, which is kind of part of the backdrop of Pesach's story, which is, we all know the story that Moshe, when he was a little baby Moshe floating, so Bas Paro finds him and they want to nurse him because he's crying, and he won't nurse from anyone who's non-Jewish. Until eventually they bring his mother, they bring Yocheved. So the Shulchan Aruch asks the question, can a Jewish baby nurse from a non-Jewish woman, a wet nurse? Again, it's not so common in the modern era. Nowadays, either the mother nurses or you give this thing called formula. But for much of human history, there wasn't anything called formula. So they had people called wet nurses. Could you have a non-Jewish wet nurse? Is the milk of a non-Jewish woman kosher? Says Shulchan Aruch, absolutely, of course it's kosher, but you still shouldn't drink it. You still shouldn't use it. And how do we know this, says the Shulchan Aruch? Because the story of Moshe. So it's like Moshe wouldn't nurse. It's not something mystical. It's not kosher, but on a mystical level, it's impure. We don't want a Jewish child ingesting something that came from a non-Jewish person. Okay, that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Ask about Yaakov Kamenetsky. It doesn't make any sense. If you go back to Chazal, why did Moshe not? This isn't Rashi. Why did Moshe not nurse from the non-Jewish women who were with the princess, with Bas Paro? So the Medrash explains. Because, whether he said it, or so to speak, God said it, or subconsciously, said the very mouth that one day is going to speak, peh el peh, going to speak directly, one-on-one, panim el panim, to Hashem, that mouth should nurse from a non-Jewish, unholy, a contaminated source. In other words, it's directly connected to the uniqueness of Moshe. Because Moshe is going to be able to talk to God up on the mountain in all those years, so that mouth has to be very, very holy, even when he's a baby. So Zev Kamenetsky, how is that a source for the fact that my child and your child and our children shouldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman? Our children aren't Moshe Rabbeinu, they're not going on the mountain. Ah, says Rav Moshe, says Rav Yaakov, that's exactly the point. Already when they're babies, you have to look at them as if they could be the next Moshe Rabbeinu. We raise them with the belief that they can be superstars. And if we believe it, they'll believe it. Now again, as they get older and you see their unique personalities and abilities coming into the fore, of course a person has to adjust. That's not a good parent to pretend their whole life that your child is Moshe Rabbeinu. But the default has to be, I'm raising this child as if he or she is going to be the next Moshe. That is to say, going to do incredible, incredible things, and therefore I want to give them the best from the beginning. And again, I think this is something that I think we know in our generation seems to be even more necessary than perhaps in previous generations. But I think, Rav Yaakov was not like a modern progressive. He lived, he died already decades ago. And he was a European transplant to America. And it's not some newfangled, postmodern, modernisha thing. This is real, I think, real genuine chinuch. I just think it's even more important nowadays, perhaps, than it ever was, for our children really to have a sense that we truly do believe in them. And if not, that's something that we really need to work on. Okay. I have some more chinuch things, but since we're going to run out of time very soon, I am going to skip towards the end. Again, I'm leaving out things that are like, I think I may have told you this once in the past, or I've definitely mentioned this in another shiurim, that many years ago I heard from Rabbi Lamb that for a speaker or a rabbi to edit himself is like doing surgery on yourself and without the anesthesia. Right? Very, very hard. I have so many good things I want to share with you, but we have like 5 minutes left, so I'm going to... Incredibly painful. You don't see how much I'm suffering right now. But I'm going... The Murrah has nothing on this. But I'm going to leave out a lot of things, and I'm going to end with one last thing, which I think, I hope... is something that's very, very important, and something that I just actually came across also yesterday for the first time. And that is, after the Manash Tana and the kids and all that stuff, we say, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. Just read the text in the beginning here. We say, after we already done Maaseh Rebbe Eliezer, we did Avraham Avinu, not before the four children, I'm sorry, this is but the Baruch HaMakom part. We've already done the four rabbis in Bnei Brak, and then we say, right before the four sons, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. Right, blessed is God, He blessed us, that he gave us the Torah, and then Kineged Arba Banim, then we have the four sons, the Chacham, the Rasha, etc. So God here is referred to as Hamakom, and Baruch Hu, blessed is he. Usually we say Baruch Atah. So two questions. Why is it Baruch Hu and not Baruch Atah? Which were, you know, blessed is you, or every Baruch is Baruch Atah. Why is it Baruch Hu? But I want to start with the first question, which is, yes, it's true, I translated it correctly, Baruch Hamakom, blessed is God, but that's obviously a euphemism, and it's a very rare euphemism. Why do we refer to God here as Hamakom, the place? Right? So we actually refer to God, as far as I know, only two other times as the place. One is, of course, when we pay a Shiva call. Right? You take leave of an Ovel and you say, Baruch Hamakom Yinachem Eschem, B'toch Shar Le'etzion Shalayim. May God comfort you among all the mourners of Jerusalem and Israel. But we refer to God as Hamakom. And, of course, not as commonly, or we don't always think of it as much, but if you're in shul on Monday and Thursday, or if you just ever kumzitz or shal shudas, you may remember the song of Achenu. So we talk about Achenu, Hanetzunim, Betzara, the brothers and sisters of the Jewish people, they could be in difficult times, and Hashem, Hamakom, Yerachem Aleinu, God will have mercy on you, we hope. We ask Him to have mercy on us and take us out of from the darkness to the light. Me'afel Eliora, Me'ashivet L'Geula, you know, and then whoever is that, Dekas, whoever sings that song, and you go to Havdalah and NTSY, and it's all good. Anyway, so Hamakom Yinachem Eschem, and we have Achenu, right? Hamakom Yirachem Aleinu. God should have mercy, God should have comfort. And here we have Baruch Hamakom. What's going on? So Rav Soloveitchik explains something very, very profound. Hamakom is the term we use to describe God when we feel He's at a distance from us, when we feel distant from Him. Where is this? What's the source of this? The source comes from the Navi Yechezkel. We say it in our Kedusha, right? In Kedusha, we combine first with Kadosh Kadosh, and then with Baruch Hashem Mimkomo. Those are psukim that come from Tanakh. The rabbis didn't just make those psukim when they were writing the Siddur. They took those psukim from Tanakh. The first one in Kadosh Kadosh Kadosh, we say Malo Kol Aretz Kivodo. God, the whole world is filled with God's Kavod, meaning we can see God everywhere. That's from the Navi Yeshaya. But then we say, Baruch Hashem Mimkomo. God is blessed from His place. That's not imminence. That's distance. He's Mimkomo. He's somewhere far away. He's God. Cue the scary music. Okay? So, what's the difference between, why did one prophet, Yeshaya, describe God as being everywhere, imminent and close to us, and Yechezkel that He's distant? So the Gemara actually asks that question. And the Gemara says, you have to understand the difference. Yechezkel was prophesying. He was already in Bavel. He was already in Babylonia. He was already in Golus. Yeshaya was prophesying in Yerushalayim while the Beis Hamikdash was still standing. It wasn't easy times necessarily, but the Beis Hamikdash was still standing. Says the Gemara. The Gemara gives an analogy. It's the difference between the country bumpkin and the urbanite, the city dweller. Right? The person who lives in Manhattan or in Washington, they see something, you know, a limousine, or you're in Washington and you see Marine One of the president or something. You know, this is what you see. You see a politician or a celebrity in a restaurant, right? You live in New York, you live in D.C., you see these kind of things. When you're the villager, the country bumpkin, oh my gosh, a limousine. Or, you know, if you're at Frum and you live in one of these small communities, a kosher pizza shop. You know, this is just human nature. When you're exposed to something regularly, so says the Gemara, Yeshaya lived in the city. He was in Yerushalayim. So he felt Hashem everywhere. He was everywhere. But Yechezkel was already in Golos. God was distant. He was the villager. He didn't get to see these things. He felt very distant. He was a tourist. He wasn't a resident. So that's why in Kedusha we describe Hashem in both ways. Sometimes we feel very close to Him. Malo kol aretz kvodo. And sometimes we feel very distant. But in both cases, and this is really, again, it's an article of faith, is we declare, even when we feel distant, we still bless Hashem, because it's based on a trust that we know even when we can't see Him, He's there. Right? Kids have this thing, you know, there's a certain, I'm not a psychologist, a developmental psychologist, but there's some stage of development when every little child, right, when they don't see something, they don't think it's there. Right? You play that game with the kids, you know, where's mommy, where's Bobby, where's Soft, right? And then, you take your hand off, all of a sudden, why are they so excited? Because when they couldn't see you, they actually thought you were gone. Right? Again, it's a little sliver of time. Right? It's a magical moment. Right? You never get more nachas with such little effort than that. So when you think of it now, it's kind of silly, right? But we're all like that. We're all like that little baby. Because when we don't see Hashem, sometimes we think He's not there. So referring to Hashem as Hamakom, what, when do we do it? When someone's in Shiva, right? Even if it was a quote-unquote good death, an older person, no pain, and how often do you get the quote-unquote perfect death anyway? Is there such a thing? But in many times, the person wasn't old, or the person suffered. So it's natural, Sarah Salvechik, for the mourners, for the loved ones, to feel very distant from God when they're sitting Shiva. You know, I just saw my husband, my wife, my parent, or Rahman Al-Flan, my child. You feel very, very distant. So we say to the Avel, not the preacher to be patronizing, but as a tefillah for that Avel, Hamakom Yenachem Eschem. Even though you feel so distant from Hashem at this moment, but we hope that even from the distance, you can feel some of that love and eventually bring yourself back to feel close. Or in Achenu, right? All those things we're saying, from Shibud L'Geula, Me'afelil, or from all those bad times, Hamakom Yerachem Aleinu. Those are times where we naturally feel distant. So said Rav Salvechik, similarly, when we're at this crucial stage in the Haggadah, what comes after this are all these sections that describe all the pain the Jewish people were in, how much they were suffering in Egypt, all these kind of things. And therefore we begin this critical part of the Haggadah by saying, Hamakom. Yes, nationally. Again, also, when was the Haggadah written, the Nusach that we have now? They did a Seder from the beginning of history, right? From Egypt, and only did a Seder from Egypt, and then when they got into Israel, 40 years after that. They've always been doing Seders. But our Haggadah comes from the time already of Chazal when there was no Beis HaMikdash. Right? That's why the Manash Tana doesn't mention Karban Pesach anymore, even though in the Mishnah, Manash Tana had a question about Karban Pesach. But our Haggadah was already post-Churban. So Seder Soloveitchik, you could say, you know, the Seder is great, but come on, look at all the problems. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have a Karban Pesach. For most of Jewish history, they didn't have Israel. We're lucky, we actually at least have Israel. So we could feel very distant from all these glorious things that are being described in the Haggadah. All the great Midrashim, and the Makos, and seeing God's power, and the Jews were on top. It's very, you can feel very, very distant. And therefore we begin the section of the Haggadah, Baruch HaMakom. We, even though we are at this distance, we have faith that Hashem is there, even though we can't see Him, and we are striving to always feel that closeness, even when in many ways he feels distant. And this is why, by the way, and with this I'll conclude, I saw that in the Rabbi Weinberger Haggadah, he quoted an almost identical idea. First of all, in the name of the Vilna Gaon, that's what the difference between Baruch Hu and Baruch Atah. Right? When you speak Hashem Baruch Atah, second person, every time you make a little bracha, you're actually, it's as if Hashem's right there, right? I wouldn't talk, if I was saying, you know, you should X and Y and Z, and someone came to the room, who are you talking to? And there was nobody there, they'd think you're a little nuts. But every time we say Baruch Atah, it's a statement of faith that we believe Hashem is right there. We're talking to Him. That's why we refer to Him as Atah. If you were just thinking about something, you'd be in third person. Or hopefully you just wouldn't be talking to yourself. But Baruch Atah, you are right there. So Atah is a language of imminence, of closeness to Hashem. Baruch Hu is distant, third person, very, very far away. And I think this is, again, this is the same idea. And that's why, even, but this will really conclude, Rabbi Weinberger quoted from the Ishvitzer Rebbe, even the Russia, when he says, Maha Avoda Hazos Lachem. So we always translate that as, what is this service, you know, to you? Like, why are you doing what you do? The Ishvitzer said, he translated it differently, that the Russia is saying, Maha Avoda Hazos Lachem. Hazos, my Avoda, why do you care? Why do you, God, care about my mitzvahs? I'm a Russia. I'm far from you. Maha Avoda Hazos Lachem, what do you even care? What are you trying to put on tefillin at the kotel for me? What are you trying to do kirov on me? What are you trying to bring me back, the alienated child? Leave me alone. My avodah is, what do you care anymore? I'm already gone. And the answer is no. Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu. Even when there's distance, even when we feel distance from Hashem, even when we feel distance from sometimes Nebuch, within our own families, there can be machlokas, there can be distance within families. But it's an oracle of faith that nothing's permanent. Only God's permanent. But our distance is certainly not permanent, and our distance, hopefully, from the people in our lives that are meaningful to us, hopefully, are not permanent. So if we can, so to speak, accept this, if we work on it, we try to strive to bless Hashem and see Hashem and work to get close, even from the distance. So there's, I think I got through 6 out of the 10 things I wanted to share with you. So that means that if Mashiach doesn't come, we'll have room to give a shiur next year. But either way, I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful Pesach and a meaningful Seder, and I hope that during the Seder, or if not beyond, even if you don't remember all these Divrei Torah specifically, but I hope these are themes that you can kind of try to discuss with your children and grandchildren. I think these really are very important and could be very, very meaningful. All the best. You're welcome.